Martin of the great Duke and his two sons, and his death is ascribed to the generous refusal of delivering his children to the tyrant's lust. Yet a Byzantine historian has dropped an unguarded word of conspiracy, deliverance, and Italian succor. Such treason may be glorious, but the rebel who bravely ventures has justly forfeited his life. Nor should we blame a conqueror for destroying the enemies whom he can no longer trust. On the 18th of June, the victorious Sultan returned to Adrianople and smiled at the base and hollow embassies of the Christian princes who viewed their approaching ruin in the fall of the Eastern Empire. Constantinople had been left naked and desolate, without a prince or a people. But she could not be despoiled of the incomparable situation which marks her for the metropolis of a great empire. And the genius of the place will ever triumph over the accidents of time and fortune. Bursa and Adrianople, the ancient seats of the Ottomans, sunk into provincial towns, and Mohammed II established his own residence and that of his successors on the same commanding spot which had been chosen by Constantine. The fortifications of Galata, which might afford a shelter to the Latins, were prudently destroyed. But the damage of the Turkish cannon was soon repaired, and before the month of August, great quantities of lime had been burnt for the restoration of the walls of the capital. As the entire property of the soil and buildings, whether public or private, or profane or sacred, was now transferred to the conqueror, he first separated a space of 8 furlongs from the point of the triangle for the establishment of his seraglio, or palace. It is here, in the bosom of luxury, that the Grand Signor, as he has been emphatically named by the Italians, appears to reign over Europe and Asia. But his person, on the shores of the Bosphorus, may not always be secure from the insults of a hostile navy. In the new character of a mosque, the Cathedral of Santa Sophia was endowed with an ample revenue, crowned with lofty minarets, and surrounded with groves and fountains for the devotion and refreshment of the Muslims. The same model was imitated in the Jami, or royal mosques, and the first of these was built by Mohammed himself on the ruins of the Church of the Holy Apostles and the tombs of the Greek emperors. On the third day after the conquest, the grave of Abu Ayyub, or Job, who had fallen in the first siege of the Arabs, was revealed in a vision, and it is before the sepulchre of the martyr that the new sultans are girded with the sword of empire. Constantinople no longer appertains to the Roman historian, nor shall I enumerate the civil and religious edifices that were profaned or erected by its Turkish masters. The population was speedily renewed, and before the end of September, 5,000 families of Anatolia and Romania had obeyed the royal mandate which enjoined them, under pain of death, to occupy their new habitations in the capital. The throne of Mohammed was guarded by the numbers and fidelity of his Muslim subjects, but his rational policy aspired to collect the remnant of the Greeks, and they returned in crowds as soon as they were assured of their lives, their liberties, and the free exercise of their religion. In the election and investiture of a patriarch, the ceremonial of the Byzantine court was revived and imitated. With a mixture of satisfaction and horror, they beheld the Sultan on his throne, who delivered into the hands of Gennadius, the crosier, or pastoral staff, the symbol of his ecclesiastical office, who conducted the patriarch to the gate of the seraglio, presented him with a horse richly caparisoned, and directed the viziers and bashaws to lead him to the palace which had been allotted for his residence. The churches of Constantinople were shared between the two religions. Their limits were marked, and till it was infringed by Selim, the grandson of Mohammed, the Greeks enjoyed above 60 years the benefit of this equal partition. Encouraged by the ministers of the Divan, who wished to elude the fanaticism of the Sultan, the Christian advocates presumed to allege that this division had been an act not of generosity, but of justice, not a concession, but a compact, and that if one half of the city had been taken by storm, the other moiety had surrendered on the faith of a sacred capitulation. The original grant had indeed been consumed by fire, but the loss was supplied by the testimony of three aged Janissaries who remembered the transaction, and their venal oaths are of more weight in the opinion of Cantemir than the positive and unanimous consent of the history of the times. The remaining fragments of the Greek kingdom in Europe and Asia I shall abandon to the Turkish arms. But the final extinction of the two last dynasties which have reigned in Constantinople should terminate the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in the East. The despots of the Morea, Demetrius and Thomas, the two surviving brothers of the name of Palaeologus, were astonished by the death of the Emperor Constantine and the ruin of the monarchy. Hopeless of defense, they prepared, with the noble Greeks who adhered to their fortune, to seek a refuge in Italy, beyond the reach of the Ottoman thunder. Their first apprehensions were dispelled by the victorious sultan, who contented himself with a tribute of 12,000 ducats, and while his ambition explored the continent and the islands in search of prey, he indulged the Morea in a respite of 7 years. But this respite was a period of grief, discord, and misery. The Hexamelion, the rampart of the Isthmus, so often raised and so often subverted, could not long be defended by 300 Italian archers. The keys of Corinth were seized by the Turks. They returned from their summer excursions with a train of captives and spoil, and the complaints of the injured Greeks were heard with indifference and disdain. The Albanians, a vagrant tribe of shepherds and robbers, filled the peninsula with rapine and murder. The two despots implored the dangerous and humiliating aid of a neighboring bashaw, and when he had quelled the revolt, his lessons inculcated the rule of their future conduct. Neither the ties of blood, nor the oaths which they repeatedly pledged in the communion and before the altar, nor the stronger pressure of necessity, could reconcile or suspend their domestic quarrels. They ravaged each other's patrimony with fire and sword. The alms and succors of the West were consumed in civil hostility, and their power was only exerted in savage and arbitrary executions. The distress and revenge of the weaker rival invoked their supreme lord, and in the season of maturity and revenge, Mohammed himself declared the friend of Demetrius, and marched into the Morea with an irresistible force. When he had taken possession of Sparta, "You are too weak," said the sultan, "to control this turbulent province. I will take your daughter to my bed, and you shall pass the remainder of your life in security and honor." Demetrius sighed and obeyed, surrendered his daughter and his castles, followed to Adrianople his sovereign and son, and received for his own maintenance and that of his followers a city in Thrace and the adjacent isles of Imbros, Lemnos, and Samothrace. He was joined the next year by a companion of misfortune, the last of the Comnenian race, who, after the taking of Constantinople by the Latins, had founded a new empire on the coast of the Black Sea. In the progress of his Anatolian conquests, Mohammed invested with a fleet and army the capital of David, who presumed to style himself Emperor of Trebizond. And the negotiation was comprised in a short and peremptory question. "Will you secure your life and treasures by resigning your kingdom? Or had you rather forfeit your kingdom, your treasures, and your life?" The feeble Comnenus was subdued by his own fears, and the example of a Muslim neighbor, the prince of Sinope, who in a similar summons had yielded a fortified city with 400 cannon and 10 or 12,000 soldiers. The capitulation of Trebizond was faithfully performed, and the emperor, with his family, was transported to a castle in Romania. But on a slight suspicion of corresponding with the Persian king, David and the whole Comnenian race were sacrificed to the jealousy or avarice of the conqueror. Nor could the name of father long protect the unfortunate Demetrius from exile and confiscation. His abject submission moved the pity and contempt of the Sultan. His followers were transplanted to Constantinople, and his poverty was alleviated by a pension of 50,000 aspers, till a monastic habit and a tardy death released Palaeologus from an earthly master. It is not easy to pronounce whether the servitude of Demetrius or the exile of his brother Thomas be the most inglorious. On the conquest of the Morea, the despot escaped to Corfu and from thence to Italy with some naked adherents. His name, his sufferings, and the head of the apostle Saint Andrew entitled him to the hospitality of the Vatican, and his misery was prolonged by a pension of 6,000 ducats from the Pope and Cardinals. His two sons, Andrew and Manuel, were educated in Italy, but the eldest, contemptible to his enemies and burdensome to his friends, was degraded by the baseness of his life and marriage. A title was his sole inheritance, and that inheritance he successively sold to the kings of France and Aragon. During his transient prosperity, Charles VIII was ambitious of joining the Empire of the East with the Kingdom of Naples. In a public festival he assumed the appellation and the purple of Augustus. The Greeks rejoiced, and the Ottoman already trembled at the approach of the French chivalry. Manuel Palaeologus, the second son, was tempted to revisit his native country. His return might be grateful and could not be dangerous to the port. He was maintained at Constantinople in safety and ease, and an honorable train of Christians and Muslims attended him to the grave. If there be some animals of so generous a nature that they refuse to propagate in a domestic state, the last of the imperial race must be ascribed to an inferior kind. He accepted from the Sultan's liberality two beautiful females, and his surviving son was lost in the habit and religion of a Turkish slave. The importance of Constantinople was felt and magnified in its loss. The pontificate of Nicholas V, however peaceful and prosperous, was dishonored by the fall of the Eastern Empire, and the grief and terror of the Latins revived, or seemed to revive, the old enthusiasm of the Crusades. In one of the most distant countries of the West, Philip, Duke of Burgundy, entertained at Lille in Flanders an assembly of his nobles, and the pompous pageants of the feast were skillfully adapted to their fancy and feelings. In the midst of the banquet a gigantic Saracen entered the hall, leading a fictitious elephant with a castle on his back. A matron in a mourning robe, the symbol of religion, was seen to issue from the castle. She deplored her oppression and accused the slowness of her champions. The principal herald of the Golden Fleece advanced, bearing on his fist a live pheasant, which, according to the rites of chivalry, he presented to the Duke. At this extraordinary summons, Philip, a wise and aged prince, engaged his person and powers in the holy war against the Turks. His example was imitated by the barons and knights of the assembly. They swore to God, the Virgin, the ladies, and the pheasant. And their particular vows were not less extravagant than the general sanction of their oath. But the performance was made to depend on some future and foreign contingency, and during 12 years, to the last hour of his life, the Duke of Burgundy might be scrupulously and perhaps sincerely on the eve of his departure. had every breast glowed with that same ardour, had the union of the Christians corresponded with their bravery, had every country from Sweden to Naples supplied a just proportion of cavalry and infantry, of men and money, it is indeed probable that Constantinople would have been delivered, and that the Turks might have been chased beyond the Hellespont or the Euphrates. But the secretary of the emperor, who composed every epistle and attended every meeting, Aeneas Sylvius, a statesman and orator, describes from his own experience the repugnant state and spirit of Christendom. It is a body, says he, without a head, a republic without laws or magistrates. The Pope and the Emperor may shine as lofty titles, as splendid images, but they are unable to command, and none are willing to obey. Every state has a separate prince, and every prince has a separate interest. What eloquence could unite so many discordant and hostile powers under the same standard? Could they be assembled in arms? Who would dare to assume the office of general? What order could be maintained? What military discipline? Who would undertake to feed such an enormous multitude? Who would understand their various languages or direct their stranger and incompatible manners? What mortal could reconcile the English with the French, Genoa with Aragon, the Germans with the natives of Hungary and Bohemia? If a small number enlisted in the Holy War, they must be overthrown by the infidels. If many, by their own weight and confusion. Yet the same Aeneas, when he was raised to the papal throne under the name of Pius II, devoted his life to the prosecution of the Turkish War. In the Council of Mantua he excited some sparks of a false or feeble enthusiasm, but when the pontiff appeared at Ancona to embark in person with the troops, engagements vanished in excuses. A precise day was adjourned to an indefinite term, and his effective army consisted of some German pilgrims whom he was obliged to disband with indulgences and alms. Regardless of futurity, his successors and the powers of Italy were involved in the schemes of present and domestic ambition, and the distance or proximity of each object determined in their eyes its apparent magnitude. A more enlarged view of their interest would have taught them to maintain a defensive and naval war against the common enemy, and the support of Skanderbeg and his brave Albanians might have prevented the subsequent invasion of the kingdom of Naples. The siege and sack of Otranto by the Turks diffused a general consternation, and Pope Sixtus was preparing to fly beyond the Alps when the storm was instantly dispelled by the death of Mohammed II in the 51st year of his age. His lofty genius aspired to the conquest of Italy. He was possessed of a strong city and a capacious harbour, and the same reign might have been decorated with the trophies of the new and the ancient Rome. Chapter 69. State of Rome from the 12th century. Temporal dominion of the popes. Seditions of the city. Political heresy of Arnold of Brescia. Restoration of the Republic. The Senators. Pride of the Romans. their wars. They are deprived of the election and presence of the popes, who retire to Avignon. The Jubilee. Noble families of Rome. Feud of the Colonna and Ursini. In the first ages of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, our eye is invariably fixed on the royal city, which had given laws to the fairest portion of the globe. We contemplate her fortunes, at first with admiration, at length with pity, always with attention. And when that attention is diverted from the capital to the provinces, they are considered as so many branches which have been successively severed from the imperial trunk. The foundation of a second Rome on the shores of the Bosphorus has compelled the historian to follow the successors of Constantine, and our curiosity has been tempted to visit the most remote countries of Europe and Asia to explore the causes and the authors of the long decay of the Byzantine monarchy. By the conquest of Justinian, we have been recalled to the banks of the Tiber, to the deliverance of the ancient metropolis. But that deliverance was a change, or perhaps an aggravation, of servitude. Rome had been already stripped of her trophies, her gods, and her Caesars. Nor was the Gothic dominion more inglorious and oppressive than the tyranny of the Greeks. In the 8th century of the Christian era, a religious quarrel, the worship of images, provoked the Romans to assert their independence. Their bishop became the temporal as well as the spiritual father of a free people, and of the Western Empire, which was restored by Charlemagne. The title and image still decorate the singular constitution of modern Germany. The name of Rome must yet command our involuntary respect. The climate, whatsoever may be its influence, was no longer the same. The purity of blood had been contaminated through a thousand channels. But the venerable aspect of her ruins, and the memory of past greatness, rekindled a spark of the national character. The darkness of the Middle Ages exhibits some scenes not unworthy of our notice. Nor shall I dismiss the present work till I have reviewed the state and revolutions of the Roman city, which acquiesced under the absolute dominion of the popes, about the same time that Constantinople was enslaved by the Turkish arms. In the beginning of the 12th century, the era of the First Crusade, Rome was revered by the Latins as the metropolis of the world, as the throne of the Pope and the Emperor, who, from the Eternal City, derived their title, their honors, and the right or exercise of temporal dominion. After so long an interruption, it may not be useless to repeat that the successors of Charlemagne and the Othos were chosen beyond the Rhine in a national diet, but that these princes were content with the humble names of kings of Germany and Italy till they had passed the Alps and the Apennine to seek their imperial crown on the banks of the Tiber. At some distance from the city, their approach was saluted by a long procession of the clergy and people with palms and crosses, and the terrific emblems of wolves and lions, of dragons and eagles that floated in the military banners, represented the departed legions and cohorts of the Republic. The royal path to maintain the liberties of Rome was thrice reiterated at the bridge, the gate, and on the stairs of the Vatican, and the distribution of a customary donative feebly imitated the magnificence of the first Caesars. In the Church of St. Peter, the coronation was performed by his successor. The voice of God was confounded with that of the people, and the public consent was declared in the acclamations of long life and victory to our Lord the Pope, long life and victory to our Lord the Emperor, long life and victory to the Roman and Teutonic armies. The names of Caesar and Augustus, the laws of Constantine and Justinian, the example of Charlemagne and Otto, established the supreme dominion of the emperors. Their title and image was engraved on the papal coins. and their jurisdiction was marked by the sword of justice, which they delivered to the prefect of the city. But every Roman prejudice was awakened by the name, the language, and the manners of a barbarian lord. The Caesars of Saxony or Franconia were the chiefs of a feudal aristocracy, nor could they exercise the discipline of civil and military power, which alone secures the obedience of a distant people, impatient of servitude, though perhaps incapable of freedom. Once, and once only in his life, each emperor, with an army of Teutonic vassals, descended from the Alps. I have described the peaceful order of his entry and coronation, but that order was commonly disturbed by the clamor and sedition of the Romans, who encountered their sovereign as a foreign invader. His departure was always speedy and often shameful, and in the absence of a long reign his authority was insulted and his name was forgotten. The progress of independence in Germany and Italy undermined the foundations of the imperial sovereignty, and the triumph of the popes was the deliverance of Rome. Of her two sovereigns, the emperor had precariously reigned by the right of conquest, but the authority of the pope was founded on the soft, though more solid, basis of opinion and habit. The removal of a foreign influence restored and endeared the shepherd to his flock. Instead of the arbitrary or venal nomination of a German court, the vicar of Christ was freely chosen by the College of Cardinals, most of whom were either natives or inhabitants of the city. The applause of the magistrates and people confirmed his election, and the ecclesiastical power that was obeyed in Sweden and Britain had been ultimately derived from the suffrage of the Romans. The same suffrage gave a prince as well as a pontiff to the capital. It was universally believed that Constantine had invested the popes with the temporal dominion of Rome, and the boldest civilians, the most profane skeptics, were satisfied with disputing the right of the emperor and the validity of his gift. The truth of the fact, the authenticity of his donation, was deeply rooted in the ignorance and tradition of four centuries, and the fabulous origin was lost in the real and permanent effects. The name of Dominus, or Lord, was inscribed on the coin of the bishops. Their title was acknowledged by acclamations and oaths of allegiance, and with the free or reluctant consent of the German Caesars, they had long exercised a supreme or subordinate jurisdiction over the city and patrimony of St. Peter. The reign of the popes, which gratified the prejudices, was not incompatible with the liberties of Rome. And a more critical inquiry would have revealed a still nobler source of their power, the gratitude of a nation whom they had rescued from the heresy and oppression of the Greek tyrant. In an age of superstition, it should seem that the union of the royal and sacerdotal characters would mutually fortify each other, and that the keys of paradise would be the surest pledge of earthly obedience. The sanctity of the office might indeed be degraded by the personal vices of the man, but the scandals of the 10th century were obliterated by the austere and more dangerous virtues of Gregory the 7th and his successors. And in the ambitious contests which they maintained for the rights of the church, their sufferings or their success must equally tend to increase the popular veneration. They sometimes wandered in poverty and exile, the victims of persecution. And the apostolic zeal with which they offered themselves to martyrdom must engage the favor and sympathy of every Catholic breast. And sometimes, thundering from the Vatican, they created, judged, and deposed the kings of the world. Nor could the proudest Roman be disgraced by submitting to a priest whose feet were kissed and whose stirrup was held by the successors of Charlemagne. Even the temporal interest of the city should have protected in peace and honor the residence of the popes, from whence a vain and lazy people derived the greatest part of their subsistence and riches. The fixed revenue of the popes was probably impaired, Many of the old patrimonial estates, both in Italy and the provinces, had been invaded by sacrilegious hands. Nor could the loss be compensated by the claim, rather than the possession, of the more ample gifts of Pepin and his descendants. But the Vatican and capital were nourished by the incessant and increasing swarms of pilgrims and suppliants. The pale of Christianity was enlarged, and the Pope and cardinals were overwhelmed by the judgment of ecclesiastical and secular causes. A new jurisprudence had established in the Latin Church the right and practice of appeals. And from the north and west, the bishops and abbots were invited or summoned to solicit, to complain, to accuse, or to justify before the threshold of the apostles. A rare prodigy is once recorded that two horses, belonging to the archbishops of Mentz and Cologne, repassed the Alps, yet laden with gold and silver. But it was soon understood that the success both of the pilgrims and clients depended much less on the justice of their cause than on the value of their offering. The wealth and piety of these strangers were ostentatiously displayed, and their expenses, sacred or profane, circulated in various channels for the emolument of the Romans. Such powerful motives should have firmly attached the voluntary and pious obedience of the Roman people to their spiritual and temporal father. But the operation of prejudice and interest is often disturbed by the sallies of ungovernable passion. The Indian who fells the tree that he may gather the fruit, and the Arab who plunders the caravans of commerce, are actuated by the same impulse of savage nature which overlooks the future in the present, and relinquishes for momentary rapine the long and secure possession of the most important blessings. And it was thus that the shrine of St. Peter was profaned by the thoughtless Romans, who pillaged the offerings and wounded the pilgrims without computing the number and value of similar visits which they prevented by their inhospitable sacrilege. Even the influence of superstition is fluctuating and precarious, and the slave, whose reason is subdued, will often be delivered by his avarice or pride. A credulous devotion for the fables and oracles of the priesthood most powerfully acts on the mind of a barbarian. Yet such a mind is the least capable of preferring imagination to sense, of sacrificing to a distant motive, to an invisible, perhaps an ideal, object, the appetites and interests of the present world. In the vigor of health and youth, his practice will perpetually contradict his belief, till the pressure of age, or sickness, or calamity, awakens his terrors and compels him to satisfy the double debt of piety and remorse. I have already observed that the modern times of religious indifference are the most favorable to the peace and security of the clergy. Under the reign of superstition, they had much to hope from the ignorance, and much to fear from the violence of mankind. The wealth, whose constant increase must have rendered them the sole proprietors of the earth, was alternately bestowed by the repentant father and plundered by the rapacious son. Their persons were adored or violated, and the same idol by the hands of the same votaries was placed on the altar or trampled in the dust. In the feudal system of Europe, arms were the title of distinction and the measure of allegiance. And amidst their tumult, the still voice of law and reason was seldom heard or obeyed. The turbulent Romans disdained the yoke and insulted the impotence of their bishop, nor would his education or character allow him to exercise with decency or effect the power of the sword. The motives of his election and the frailties of his life were exposed to their familiar observation. And proximity must diminish the reverence which his name and his decrees impressed on a barbarous world. This difference has not escaped the notice of our philosophic historian. Though the name and authority of the court of Rome were so terrible in the remote countries of Europe, which were sunk in profound ignorance and were entirely unacquainted with its character and conduct, The Pope was so little revered at home that his inveterate enemies surrounded the gates of Rome itself and even controlled his government in that city. And the ambassadors, who from a distant extremity of Europe carried to him the humble, or rather abject, submissions of the greatest potentate of the age, found the utmost difficulty to make their way to him and to throw themselves at his feet. Since the primitive times, the wealth of the popes was exposed to envy, their powers to opposition, and their persons to violence. But the long hostility of the mitre and the crown increased the numbers and inflamed the passions of their enemies. The deadly factions of the Guelphs and Ghibellines, so fatal to Italy, could never be embraced with truth or constancy by the Romans, the subjects and adversaries both of the bishop and emperor. But their support was solicited by both parties, and they alternately displayed in their banners the keys of St. Peter and the German eagle. Gregory the Seventh, who may be adored or detested as the founder of the papal monarchy, was driven from Rome and died in exile at Salerno. 36 of his successors, till their retreat to Avignon, maintained an unequal contest with the Romans. Their age and dignity were often violated, and the churches, in the solemn rites of religion, were polluted with sedition and murder. A repetition of such capricious brutality, without connection or design, would be tedious and disgusting. And I shall content myself with some events of the 12th century, which represent the state of the popes and the city. On Holy Thursday, while Pascal officiated before the altar, he was interrupted by the clamors of the multitude, who imperiously demanded the confirmation of a favorite magistrate. His silence exasperated their fury. His pious refusal to mingle the affairs of earth and heaven was encountered with menaces and oaths that he should be the cause and the witness of the public ruin. During the festival of Easter, while the bishop and the clergy, barefooted and in procession, visited the tombs of the martyrs, they were twice assaulted at the bridge of St. Angelo and before the capital with volleys of stones and darts. The houses of his adherents were leveled with the ground. Pascal escaped with difficulty and danger. He levied an army in the patrimony of St. Peter, and his last days were embittered by suffering and inflicting the calamities of civil war. The scenes that followed the election of his successor Galasius II were still more scandalous to the church and city. Cencio Frangipani, a potent and factious baron, burst into the assembly, furious and in arms. The cardinals were stripped, beaten, and trampled underfoot, and he seized, without pity or respect, the vicar of Christ by the throat. Galasius was dragged by the hair along the ground, buffeted with blows, wounded with spurs, and bound with an iron chain in the house of his brutal tyrant. An insurrection of the people delivered their bishop. The rival families opposed the violence of the Frangipani. And Cencio, who sued for pardon, repented of the failure rather than of the guilt of his enterprise. Not many days had elapsed when the Pope was again assaulted at the altar. While his friends and enemies were engaged in a bloody contest, he escaped in his sacerdotal garments. In this unworthy flight, which excited the compassion of the Roman matrons, his attendants were scattered or unhorsed, and in the fields behind the church of St. Peter, his successor was found alone and half dead with fear and fatigue. Shaking the dust from his feet, the apostle withdrew from a city in which his dignity was insulted and his person was endangered. And the vanity of sacerdotal ambition is revealed in the involuntary confession that one emperor was more tolerable than 20. These examples might suffice, but I cannot forget the sufferings of 2 pontiffs of the same age, the 2nd and 3rd of the name of Lucius. The former, as he ascended in battle array to assault the capital, was struck on the temple by a stone and expired in a few days. The latter was severely wounded in the person of his servants. In a civil commotion, several of his priests had been made prisoners, and the inhuman Romans, reserving one as a guide for his brethren, put out their eyes, crowned them with ludicrous mitres, mounted them on asses with their faces towards the tail, and extorted an oath that, in this wretched condition, they should offer themselves as a lesson to the head of the church. Hope or fear, lassitude or remorse, the characters of the men and the circumstances of the times might sometimes obtain an interval of peace and obedience, and the Pope was restored with joyful acclamations to the Lateran or Vatican, from whence he had been driven with threats and violence. But the root of mischief was deep and perennial, and a momentary calm was preceded and followed by such tempests as had almost sunk the bark of St. Peter. Rome continually presented the aspect of war and discord. The churches and palaces were fortified and assaulted by the factions and families. And after giving peace to Europe, Callistus II alone had resolution and power to prohibit the use of private arms in the metropolis. Among the nations who revered the apostolic throne, the tumults of Rome provoked a general indignation. And in a letter to his disciple Eugenius III, St. Bernard, with the sharpness of his wit and zeal, has stigmatized the vices of the rebellious people. "Who is ignorant," says the monk of Clairvaux, "of the vanity and arrogance of the Romans? A nation nursed in sedition, untractable, and scorning to obey unless they are too feeble to resist. When they promise to serve, they aspire to reign. If they swear allegiance, they watch the opportunity of revolt. Yet they vent their discontent in loud clamors, if your doors or your councils are shut against them. Dexterous in mischief, they have never learned the science of doing good. Odious to earth and heaven, impious to God, seditious among themselves, jealous of their neighbors, inhuman to strangers, they love no one, by no one are they beloved. And while they wish to inspire fear, they live in base and continual apprehension. They will not submit. They know not how to govern, faithless to their superiors, intolerable to their equals, ungrateful to their benefactors, and alike impudent in their demands and their refusals. Lofty in promise, poor in execution, adulation and calumny, perfidy and treason are the familiar arts of their policy." Surely this dark portrait is not colored by the pencil of Christian charity. Yet the features, however harsh or ugly, express a lively resemblance of the Roman of the 12th century. The Jews had rejected the Christ when he appeared among them in a plebeian character, and the Romans might plead their ignorance of his vicar when he assumed the pomp and pride of a temporal sovereign. In the busy age of the Crusades, some sparks of curiosity and reason were kindled in the Western world. The heresy of Bulgaria, the Paulician sect, was successfully transplanted into the soil of Italy and France. The Gnostic visions were mingled with the simplicity of the gospel, and the enemies of the clergy reconciled their passions with their conscience, the desire of freedom with the profession of piety. The trumpet of Roman liberty was first sounded by Arnold of Brescia, whose promotion in the church was confined to the lowest rank, and who wore the monastic habit rather as a garb of poverty than as a uniform of obedience. His adversaries could not deny the wit and eloquence which they severely felt. They confess with reluctance the specious purity of his morals, and his errors were recommended to the public by a mixture of important and beneficial truths. In his theological studies he had been the disciple of the famous and unfortunate Abelard, who was likewise involved in the suspicion of heresy. But the lover of Eloisa was of a soft and flexible nature, and his ecclesiastic judges were edified and disarmed by the humility of his repentance. From this master, Arnold most probably imbibed some metaphysical definitions of the Trinity, repugnant to the taste of the times. His ideas of baptism and the Eucharist are loosely censured, but a political heresy was the source of his fame and misfortunes. He presumed to quote the declaration of Christ that his kingdom is not of this world. He boldly maintained that the sword and the scepter were entrusted to the civil magistrate, that temporal honors and possessions were lawfully vested in secular persons, that the abbots, the bishops, and the Pope himself must renounce either their state or their salvation, and that after the loss of their revenues, the voluntary tithes and oblations of the faithful would suffice, not indeed for luxury and avarice, but for a frugal life in the exercise of spiritual labors. During a short time, the preacher was revered as a patriot, and the discontent or revolt of Brescia against her bishop was the first fruits of his dangerous lessons. But the favor of the people is less permanent than the resentment of the priest, and after the heresy of Arnold had been condemned by Innocent II in the General Council of the Lateran, the magistrates themselves were urged by prejudice and fear to execute the sentence of the Church. Italy could no longer afford a refuge, and the disciple of Abelard escaped beyond the Alps till he found a safe and hospitable shelter in Zurich, now the first of the Swiss cantons. From a Roman station, a royal villa, a chapter of noble virgins, Zurich had gradually increased to a free and flourishing city, where the appeals of the Milanese were sometimes tried by the imperial commissaries. In an age less ripe for reformation, the precursor of Zwinglius was heard with applause, a brave and simple people imbibed, and long retained the color of his opinions, and his art or merit seduced the Bishop of Constance and even the Pope's legate, who forgot, for his sake, the interest of their master and their order. Their tardy zeal was quickened by the fierce exhortations of Saint Bernard, and the enemy of the Church was driven by persecution to the desperate measures of erecting his standard in Rome itself in the face of the successor of Saint Peter. Yet the courage of Arnold was not devoid of discretion. He was protected, and had perhaps been invited by the nobles and people. And in the service of freedom his eloquence thundered over the seven hills. Blending in the same discourse the texts of Livy and St. Paul, uniting the motives of gospel and of classic enthusiasm, he admonished the Romans how strangely their patience and the vices of the clergy had degenerated from the primitive times of the church and the city. He exhorted them to assert the inalienable rights of men and Christians, to restore the laws and magistrates of the Republic, to respect the name of the emperor, but to confine their shepherd to the spiritual government of his flock. Nor could his spiritual government escape the censure and control of the reformer, and the inferior clergy were taught by his lessons to resist the cardinals who had usurped a despotic command over the 28 regions or parishes of Rome. The revolution was not accomplished without rapine and violence, the effusion of blood, and the demolition of houses. The victorious faction was enriched with the spoils of the clergy and the adverse nobles. Arnold of Brescia enjoyed, or deplored, the effects of his mission. His reign continued above 10 years, while two popes, Innocent II and Anastasius IV, either trembled in the Vatican or wandered as exiles in the adjacent cities. They were succeeded by a more vigorous and fortunate pontiff, Adrian IV, the only Englishman who has ascended the throne of St. Peter, and whose merit emerged from the mean condition of a monk and almost a beggar in the monastery of St. Albans. On the first provocation of a cardinal killed or wounded in the streets, he cast an interdict on the guilty people. And from Christmas to Easter, Rome was deprived of the real or imaginary comforts of religious worship. The Romans had despised their temporal prince. They submitted with grief and terror to the censures of their spiritual father. Their guilt was expiated by penance, and the banishment of the seditious preacher was the price of their absolution. But the revenge of Adrian was yet unsatisfied, and the approaching coronation of Frederick Barbarossa was fatal to the bold reformer, who had offended, though not in an equal degree, the heads of the church and state. In their interview at Viterbo, the Pope represented to the Emperor the furious, ungovernable spirit of the Romans, the insults, the injuries, the fears to which his person and his clergy were continually exposed, and the pernicious tendency of the heresy of Arnold, which must subvert the principles of civil as well as ecclesiastical subordination. Frederick was convinced by these arguments, or tempted by the desire of the imperial crown. In the balance of ambition, the innocence or life of an individual is of small account, and their common enemy was sacrificed to a moment of political concord. After his retreat from Rome, Arnold had been protected by the Viscounts of Campania, from whom he was extorted by the power of Caesar. The prefect of the city pronounced his sentence. The martyr of freedom was burnt alive in the presence of a careless and ungrateful people, and his ashes were cast into the Tiber, lest the heretics should collect and worship the relics of their master. The clergy triumphed in his death. With his ashes, his sect was dispersed. His memory still lived in the minds of the Romans. From his school they had probably derived a new article of faith, that the metropolis of the Catholic Church is exempt from the penalties of excommunication and interdict. Their bishops might argue that the supreme jurisdiction, which they exercised over kings and nations, more specially embraced the city and diocese of the Prince of the Apostles. But they preached to the winds, and the same principle that weakened the effect must temper the abuse of the thunders of the Vatican. The love of ancient freedom has encouraged a belief that as early as the 10th century, in their first struggles against the Saxon Otters, the Commonwealth was vindicated and restored by the Senate and people of Rome, that two consuls were annually elected among the nobles, and that 10 or 12 plebeian magistrates revived the name and office of the tribunes of the commons. But this venerable structure disappears before the light of criticism. In the darkness of the Middle Ages, the appellations of senators, of consuls, of the sons of consuls, may sometimes be discovered. They were bestowed by the emperors, or assumed by the most powerful citizens, to denote their rank, their honors, and perhaps the claim of a pure and patrician descent. But they float on the surface without a series or a substance, the titles of men, not the orders of government. And it is only from the year of Christ, 1144, that the establishment of the Senate is dated as a glorious era in the acts of the city. A new constitution was hastily framed by private ambition or popular enthusiasm. Nor could Rome in the 12th century produce an antiquary to explain or a legislator to restore the harmony and proportions of the ancient model. The assembly of a free or an armed people will ever speak in loud and weighty acclamations, but the regular distribution of the 35 tribes, the nice balance of the wealth and numbers of the centuries, the debates of the adverse orators, and the slow operation of votes and ballots could not easily be adapted by a blind multitude, ignorant of the arts and insensible of the benefits of legal government. It was proposed by Arnold to revive and discriminate the equestrian order. But what could be the motive or measure of such distinction? The pecuniary qualification of the knights must have been reduced to the poverty of the times. Those times no longer required their civil functions of judges and farmers of the revenue, and their primitive duty, their military service on horseback, was more nobly supplied by feudal tenures and the spirit of chivalry. The jurisprudence of the Republic was useless and unknown. The nations and families of Italy who lived under the Roman and barbaric laws were insensibly mingled in a common mass. And some faint tradition, some imperfect fragments, preserved the memory of the Code and Pandects of Justinian. With their liberty, the Romans might doubtless have restored the appellation and office of consuls, had they not disdained a title so promiscuously adopted to the Italian cities that it has finally settled on the humble station of the agents of commerce in a foreign land. But the rights of the tribunes, the formidable word that arrested the public councils, suppose or must produce a legitimate democracy. The old patricians were the subjects, the modern barons the tyrants of the state. Nor would the enemies of peace and order who insulted the vicar of Christ have long respected the unarmed sanctity of a plebeian magistrate. In the revolution of the 12th century, which gave a new existence and era to Rome, we may observe the real and important events that marked or confirmed her political independence. The Capitoline Hill, one of her seven eminences, is about 400 yards in length and 200 in breadth. A flight of 100 steps led to the summit of the Tarpeian Rock, and far steeper was the ascent before the declivities had been smoothed and the precipices filled by the ruins of fallen edifices. From the earliest ages, the Capitol had been used as a temple in peace, a fortress in war. After the loss of the city, it maintained a siege against the victorious Gauls, and the sanctuary of the empire was occupied, assaulted, and burnt in the civil wars of Vitellius and Vespasian. The temples of Jupiter and his kindred deities had crumbled into dust. Their place was supplied by monasteries and houses, and the solid walls, the long and shelving porticoes, were decayed or ruined by the lapse of time. It was the first act of the Romans, an act of freedom, to restore the strength, though not the beauty, of the capital, to fortify the seat of their arms and councils, and as often as they ascended the hill, the coldest minds must have glowed with the remembrance of their ancestors. The first Caesars had been invested with the exclusive coinage of the gold and silver. To the Senate they abandoned the baser metal of bronze or copper. The emblems and legends were inscribed on a more ample field by the genius of flattery. Then the prince was relieved from the care of celebrating his own virtues. The successors of Diocletian despised even the flattery of the Senate. Their royal officers at Rome and in the provinces assumed the sole direction of the mint, and the same prerogative was inherited by the Gothic kings of Italy and the long series of the Greek, the French, and the German dynasties. After an abdication of 800 years, the Roman Senate asserted this honorable and lucrative privilege, which was tacitly renounced by the popes, from Pascal II to the establishment of their residence beyond the Alps. Some of these Republican coins of the 12th and 13th centuries are shown in the cabinets of the curious. On one of these, a gold medal, Christ is depicted holding in his left hand a book with this inscription: "The Vow of the Roman Senate and People, Rome, the Capital of the World." On the reverse, St. Peter, delivering a banner to a kneeling senator in his cap and gown, with the name and arms of his family impressed on a shield. With the empire, the prefect of the city had declined to a municipal officer, yet he still exercised, in the last appeal, the civil and criminal jurisdiction. And a drawn sword, which he received from the successors of Otto, was the mode of his investiture and the emblem of his functions. The dignity was confined to the noble families of Rome. The choice of the people was ratified by the Pope, but a triple oath of fidelity must have often embarrassed the prefect in the conflict of adverse duties. A servant, in whom they possessed but a third share, was dismissed by the independent Romans. In his place they elected a patrician, but this title, which Charlemagne had not disdained, was too lofty for a citizen or a subject, and after the first fervour of rebellion, they consented without reluctance to the restoration of the prefect. About 50 years after this event, Innocent III, the most ambitious or at least the most fortunate of the pontiffs, delivered the Romans and himself from this badge of foreign dominion. He invested the prefect with a banner instead of a sword, and absolved him from all dependence of oaths or service to the German emperors. In his place, an ecclesiastic, a present or future cardinal, was named by the Pope to the civil government of Rome. But his jurisdiction has been reduced to a narrow compass, and in the days of freedom the right or exercise was derived from the Senate and people. After the revival of the Senate, the conscript fathers, if I may use the expression, were invested with the legislative and executive power. But their views seldom reached beyond the present day, and that day was most frequently disturbed by violence and tumult. In its utmost plenitude, the order or assembly consisted of 56 senators, the most eminent of whom were distinguished by the title of counselors. They were nominated, perhaps annually, by the people, and a previous choice of their electors, 10 persons in each region or parish, might afford a basis for a free and permanent constitution. The popes, who in this tempest submitted rather to bend than to break, confirmed by treaty the establishment and privileges of the Senate, and expected from time, peace, and religion the restoration of their government. The motives of public and private interest might sometimes draw from the Romans an occasional and temporary sacrifice of their claims, and they renewed their oath of allegiance to the successor of St. Peter and Constantine, the lawful head of the Church and the Republic. The union and vigor of a public council was dissolved in a lawless city, and the Romans soon adopted a more strong and simple mode of administration. They condensed the name and authority of the Senate in a single magistrate or two colleagues, and as they were changed at the end of a year, or of 6 months, the greatness of the trust was compensated by the shortness of the term. But in this transient reign, the senators of Rome indulged their avarice and ambition. Their justice was perverted by the interest of their family and faction, and as they punished only their enemies, they were obeyed only by their adherents. Anarchy, no longer tempered by the pastoral care of their bishop, admonished the Romans that they were incapable of governing themselves, and they sought abroad those blessings which they were hopeless of finding at home. In the same age, and from the same motives, most of the Italian republics were prompted to embrace a measure which, however strange it may seem, was adapted to their situation and productive of the most salutary effects. They chose in some foreign but friendly city an impartial magistrate of noble birth and unblemished character, a soldier and a statesman, recommended by the voice of fame and his country, to whom they delegated for a time the supreme administration of peace and war. The compact between the governor and the governed was sealed with oaths and subscriptions, and the duration of his power, the measure of his stipend, the nature of their mutual obligations were defined with scrupulous precision. They swore to obey him as their lawful superior. He pledged his faith to unite the indifference of a stranger with the zeal of a patriot. At his choice, 4 or 6 knights and civilians, his assessors in arms and justice, attended the podesta, who maintained at his own expense a decent retinue of servants and horses. His wife, his son, his brother, who might bias the affections of the judge, were left behind. During the exercise of his office he was not permitted to purchase land, to contract an alliance, or even to accept an invitation in the house of a citizen. Nor could he honorably depart till he had satisfied the complaints that might be urged against his government. It was thus, about the middle of the 13th century, that the Romans called from Bologna the senator Brancaleone, whose fame and merit had been rescued from oblivion by the pen of an English historian. A just anxiety for his reputation, a clear foresight of the difficulties of the task, had engaged him to refuse the honour of their choice. The statutes of Rome were suspended, and his office prolonged to the term of 3 years. By the guilty and licentious he was accused as cruel. By the clergy he was suspected as partial. But the friends of peace and order applauded the firm and upright magistrate by whom those blessings were restored. No criminals were so powerful as to brave, so obscure as to elude the justice of the senator. By his sentence, two nobles of the Annibaldi family were executed on a gibbet, and he inexorably demolished in the city and neighbourhood 140 towers, the strong shelters of rapine and mischief. The bishop, as a simple bishop, was compelled to reside in his diocese, and the standard of Brancaleone was displayed in the field with terror and effect. His services were repaid by the ingratitude of a people unworthy of the happiness which they enjoyed. By the public robbers whom he had provoked for their sake, the Romans were excited to depose and imprison their benefactor. Nor would his life have been spared if Bologna had not possessed a pledge for his safety. Before his departure, the prudent senator had required the exchange of 30 hostages of the noblest families of Rome. On the news of his danger, and at the prayer of his wife, they were more strictly guarded. And Bologna, in the cause of honour, sustained the thunders of a papal interdict. This generous resistance allowed the Romans to compare the present with the past, and Brancaleone was conducted from the prison to the capital amidst the acclamations of a repentant people. The remainder of his government was firm and fortunate, and as soon as envy was appeased by death, his head, enclosed in a precious vase, was deposited on a lofty column of marble. The impotence of reason and virtue recommended in Italy a more effectual choice. Instead of a private citizen, to whom they yielded a voluntary and precarious obedience, the Romans elected for their senator some prince of independent power, who could defend them from their enemies and themselves. Charles of Anjou and Provence, the most ambitious and warlike monarch of the age, accepted at the same time the kingdom of Naples from the Pope and the office of senator from the Roman people. As he passed through the city in his road to victory, he received their oath of allegiance, lodged in the Lateran palace, and smoothed in a short visit the harsh features of his despotic character. Yet even Charles was exposed to the inconstancy of the people, who saluted with the same acclamations the passage of his rival, the unfortunate Conradin, and a powerful avenger who reigned in the capital alarmed the fears and jealousy of the popes. The absolute term of his life was superseded by renewal every 3rd year, and the enmity of Nicholas III obliged the Sicilian king to abdicate the government of Rome. In his bull, A Perpetual Law, the imperious pontiff asserts the truth, validity, and use of the donation of Constantine, not less essential to the peace of the city than to the independence of the church, establishes the annual election of the senator, and formally disqualifies all emperors, kings, princes, and persons of an eminent and conspicuous rank. This prohibitory clause was repealed in his own behalf by Martin IV,